Alright, time for another DoNotGod.com video presentation and such. So, continuing, part two, something like that. Continuing this conversation between some guy, Michael, whatever it is, Graziano, and this other guy, whatever his name was. Robinson something or other. Anyway, and just about what are brains doing? What are brains doing? Yeah, close enough.
And model the attention of another creature. So it has, I don't know if you want to call it like a second or.
So the guy has a basic theory that this is all the important thing is how we acquire attention. You know, how our attention is gained. And how we somehow watch how other people or model how other people are attentive when in a lot of ways we don't pay any attention to that at all when you think about it, right? There's a lot of things we don't pay attention to in terms of recognizing that, oh, somebody's going to notice I didn't do anything with my hair. It's a little straggly and shitty. I didn't bother. I'm not bothering trying to get your attention or keep your attention or any of that. So, and even if I tried to model it, the model would be so non-general. I mean, you couldn't apply it to all people in any way. So I think this is just not very interesting, but let's see where it goes.
Attention, yeah. Schema. Would you be more inclined to conclude that that creature has a first order attention schema and thus might be worthy of being called conscious?
Yeah. So there's a question: which came first? Is it the social ability to understand the attention of other creatures, or is it an ability to model and understand one's own attention?
All right. So I'm just like, but no. What does this have to do with anything? I really don't think it has anything to do with evolution or any of this. So it's like, no, I don't even think a peacock is aware of the fact that it has feathers and the feathers are what's attracting the bitches.
And there are people who argue that. The theory, AST, attention schema theory, is actually agnostic on that one. I mean, whichever came first. My own opinion is probably one's own models come first. They're just enormously useful. So the idea of building a model of something is it makes it easier to control it. So the brain builds a model of your arm. It's called the arm schema. And that's just a little model in there that's like a simulated arm that tells you what your arm is doing and what it's likely to do in the future. And when that model gets damaged, you have...
Muscle memory is not really anything to do with attention. And so, I think that's just, again, it's just so opposite attention in a way. I mean, so many of the things we do relying on muscle memory, the more we think about doing it, the worse we'll do it. So if you're playing horseshoes or doing some other thing, the last thing you want to do is think about where your hand is and where your arm is and all this other crap. You really just want to think about, the target and the idea, because your body already knows how to do the rest, and if you start thinking about it, you'll just distract it. So I don't, whatever. Hopefully this will get to some other subject. We're not going to just talk about whatever this attention schema crap is.
Terrible trouble controlling your arm. So the model, these schemas or models, are really important in control, and attention is something we have to control. Like, we move our attention around the world in very precisely controlled ways. I don't think we'd be able to do that without an ability to monitor and predict our own attention. So
I don't think we predict very well. And there's obviously a clock that runs inside of us, I would argue, where you get into regular habits of your brain is checking, is there something I set an alarm for? Something I'm supposed to do in an hour, and so it remembers, maybe it remembers in an hour and a half, maybe it remembers in a half hour, but it does re-inject it into consciousness and say, oh yeah, you're supposed to,
I think one's own attention model comes first. And it's only much later in evolution that it expands and turns into the social model, and we start applying it to other creatures. That's my guess. Other people can have different guesses.
I think it just depends on what kind of organism it is. So if it's a social organism, it's obviously going to be more aware of all the other triggers. So a bird looks at the other birds and say, what's up? You know, what are we doing? And it waits for the king bird to decide, like the geese flying, you know, or something else. One of them gets to be king for the day, and he decides what everybody else is going to do.
But I'm guessing that that's what happens, that your self model starts first. Yeah.
What I had in mind in asking that question is, a number of years ago, I was very interested in folk psychology, so I was reading a lot of papers about folk theory of mind, and I was reading some of the studies that Simon Baron Cohen had conducted on people with autism, and this got me down a rabbit hole where I was reading about studies where researchers were trying to determine whether or not chimpanzees had theories of other minds, and it seems that they do, perhaps, obviously not to the same degree that we have.
Oh, brother. What a pile of mush. Anyway, okay, I started the video, we're going to finish it, but boy, this part sucks. Well, yeah, let me speed it up a little. That'll help.
Yeah, so theory of mind is tricky, yeah. There's a classic test of theory of mind, which is the false belief test, that people have used for a long time. And the false belief test, basically, you know, the idea, so the classic false belief test, you have two boxes. You tell somebody a story. Here's the story. There's Sally and there's Anne, and they're in front of two picnic baskets. And Anne puts her sandwich in basket A, and the basket's closed. And then Anne goes to the bathroom. And Sally, who's a devious little jerk, takes the sandwich out of basket A and puts it in basket B and then closes the tops. Anne comes back. Where will she look for her sandwich first? And most adults will say, she thought it was in box A. That's where she put it. That's where she's going to look. But most little kids say she's going to look in basket B because that's where it is. Because they don't yet have a fully developed concept that Anne has a mind, and that Anne's mind contains information that happens to be false. And so she's going to act on that information. So it takes a certain amount of sophistication to understand that another creature has...
I don't even think the kids understand the question. I think that's the problem. You're not explaining to them. You know, they're probably asking the question in some way that the kid is like, well, what do you mean? You know, and so they get the wrong answer. But, I mean, you know, I can't even believe you could tell me that when I was a kid, I would have said something that stupid. No chance.
The mind of its own and acts on that information.
They just tricked the kids with word games.
And so then people began to ask, okay, at what point do humans develop theory of mind? And what other animals have theory of mind as measured by this test? But it turns out the test is incredibly stringent, probably over-stringent. The young children, for one thing, have trouble understanding the language and the words. And so you have to figure out ways of asking the question really simply. And then
there you go. So you just confuse them. Because they know if they knew the sandwich had been moved, that they would go where they knew it was moved to if they knew it was moved. And so it's just them understanding the concept of somebody doing something dishonest, and they don't have a fully developed understanding of deception yet. So that's what you're tricking them, because they don't really understand, we're talking about fooling people, because it's not something intuitive to them. They're not saying, as soon as they're born, they're not saying, how do I trick people? How do I fool people? No, that's not what they're thinking.
Find out that younger and younger children pass the test, younger than people had previously thought, because just the framing of the question was too complicated. And then you try to go to other animals, and it turns out it isn't so much that they don't understand about other minds. It's just that the test is this really complicated shell game. It's like asking them to do calculus or something. Like, they can't keep track of the boxes and this and that. But probably a huge range of other animals have the ability to understand something about the mind states of each other. And so even though, you know, chimpanzees and some crows and maybe an animal here or there passes the false belief test, and then people get very excited and say, oh, they have theory of mind. Probably a much huger range of animals has the essential components of theory of mind. They can look at someone like, there's a wonderful study with dogs.
So they didn't even tell us this false belief test that you could give to an animal. How can you give the test to an animal? Because you're describing a deception. So how do you, it's impossible. Obviously, if they get to see the movement of the banana from one box to another, they're going to see it move from one box to another. They're going to know what box it's in. So there's no way to explain that to an animal. So this is just such bullshit.
When dogs play, one dog waggles its tail and jumps around and gets the other dog to play. But if the one dog is not looking, you know, like dog A wants to play with dog B and dog B is not looking. Dog A knows that. Dog A is essentially thinking, well, I get dog B's perspective in mind. He's not looking at me. I got to do something else. And then dog A is more likely to bark to attract attention. Then when dog B looks, then dog A can start jumping and playing. And so they understand each other's perspectives to some extent. They understand they have separate minds and that you have to attract attention and what attention is in the other animal and so on. Even though dogs, as far as I know, fail the false belief task. So theory of mind in the most...
As far as he knows... This is so uninteresting.
General sense is probably present in a huge range of animals. Again, it wouldn't surprise me if it was basically mammals and birds.
Pretense or play is obviously another very big field of research and connected to theory of mind. So I'm remembering also reading studies where you would have children and somebody picks up a banana and uses it as a cell phone, and you need to have a theory.
No, this is just, you know, I mean, all of this just has to do with being physical in the universe and practicing being physical in the universe. So we know that cats do all of this stuff because they have to catch mice later. They have to do things that are going to require them to have all kinds of coordination and muscle memory skills, and that's what it's all about.
Their mind for a child to recognize that it's a cell phone and not just a banana. And it kind of reminds me of this idea with the dogs playing. But so what we've been talking about are, I mean, second order maybe attention schemas. And I'm wondering what sort of tests you would run on a human or a dog or a chimpanzee to determine whether or not they have this first order attention schema.
Well,
humans we know, but...
Right. My research is certainly on humans because it's much easier to do the experiments because you can ask them. And also you can give them instructions as to how to do the experiment. So even if you're just asking them to press buttons and look at lights, it's to train a non-human animal for a year and a half to press the right buttons is a bit costly. To train to tell a person in 30 seconds, that's easy. So my lab focuses on humans, but in principle, the same things could be done. I mean, I think that any creature that has...
The same things can be done. So why wouldn't you make it rudimentary where all things can be tested with the same test? And the fact is that this is just a waste of time.
Selective attention. And there are tons of creatures that do. And there's vast amounts of research that shows, you know, that birds have attention and mice have attention and dogs have attention. And attention in the sense that you can, they can choose to, or a flashy thing in the environment can pull their attention. And once they attend to something, they process it in depth. At the cost of...
I mean, it's just silly, just because you can see... I mean, look at it. You can just use a laser pointer with a cat. You can drive the cat nuts. So obviously you can trigger them, okay, to become focused on something, and they'll be really focused and really intense. And a lot of that is just an instinct of reaction because they have to react quickly. Everything all about their existence relies on them being faster than the thing they're trying to catch.
Processing other things, right? If you have that, and if you can control it. So there's something called top-down attention. There's like bottom-up attention is the flashy, noisy things in the environment grab your attention. But we're not a slave to that. We have the ability to force our attention on the things that are important to us. That's top-down control of attention. If you have that top-down control, I think on principle, just on the very, there's principles of what's control, called control theory. If you can control it, you have a model of it. Because you need a model. You need to predict it and you need to monitor it in order to control it, whatever it is. So I think that...
So again, this is just nonsense because we get all kinds of mental memories driving. We get really lazy when we're driving sometimes just because, we've done this so many times. We know how to do it. Same route. It's almost like your body remembers when you drive the same, at least I found when I drive, I used to drive the same thing every single night driving home from work. And it's like I could fall asleep and I could still drive home. I mean, it was just, it's like, you didn't need to pay any attention, almost.
Any animal with top-down control over its own attention has a model of attention, has a very basic, reflexive, built-in, I guess, what you mean by a first-order model of attention. That's what I would guess. I think on principle that's probably has to be true.
So since you're...
So some word like concentration and focus, okay. So yeah, this is part of being alive is that you do this focusing thing. You know, you see something unusual. Right now there's somebody walking their dogs and they have a cat that walks with them, okay? It's not on a leash, but it walks down the sidewalk with the little dogs. And it's really unusual, right? I mean, very few cats will not get run over, you know, or even will do it in the first place. They're just not interested in going for a walk. But these people know how to train a cat to do it. So they have more than one cat that's done it. So that's a little suspicious in the sense that the cats don't last one a year or two. So maybe they're not, you know, maybe it doesn't work out as well as they're, as it looks. But I'm just saying it looks pretty impressive to have a cat playing along and pretending to be a dog, essentially. So it attracts your attention because it's just distinctly different. It's unusual. It's all this kind of stuff. So yes, your brain says this is so fucked up. So what's so, is this really all that interesting? No, sorry. It's not that interesting, right? That my brain would recognize something that's out of the pattern and there would be some, it would be conducive to an evolutionarily, a pattern that would be reasonably effective in keeping you alive would be you noticing when something's different.
Doing most of your studies on humans, would your general methodology for ascertaining whether other animals have consciousness...
I mean, this whole thing is just pattern matching, and again, you're just looking for things that really match a pattern or really don't match a pattern.
Just be trying to identify what the human neural structures are that are connected to the attention schema, and then looking back and saying, okay, the birds have the waltz, which is connected. It's similar to the cortex.
That's part of it. But then you get into animals like octopuses, right, where the evolutionary path is totally different, and they have really different brain structures that are not easily comparable. And you run into the artificial intelligence problem, and that's something that my lab is now working on quite a bit. How can you understand or build these kinds of systems artificially? And then, of course, it doesn't look anything like it. Like, the brain structures aren't the same. And so how do you tell? How do you know?
So you could see how that wouldn't make too much difference, but some of the brain structures really just have to do with what kind of sense organs you're dependent on. So you could understand, and the very fact that you're, you know, an octopus's mouth don't look the same either. They got a beak and all this, you know, different little things that are different. You can understand, but yes, it's still the same principle. It's still after the same thing. You know, some way to hold the food, catch it, hold it, break it. You know, all these kind of rules. And so the fact that the brain is even like the octopus, the arms are different. Well, the fact that the brain has different appearance to the way it's grabbing things or manipulating ideas or manipulating the reactions the brain has. So what? You could still argue that it's really going to be doing the same thing. And it's just doing it in a subtly different manner. And, you know, the argument would still be if the octopus is learning, it still has to have a reward and punishment system. So, and it's just really telling you that, yes, the capacity to feel probably is before the octopus branched off. So the trilobite or something was probably the place where ouch started. Well, it's probably a worm, frankly.
And you have to look at it much more at the algorithmic level and ask what are the capabilities of the agent. And so,
I mean, it's just a fact. Earthworms can learn to go one direction because another direction is uncomfortable. So they can learn to turn right. So, you know, it isn't that hard to say that, well, you know, what's teaching them? Well, it's the bad sensation they get when they turn left.
Yes. So I'll give you an example. And this isn't really, it's consciousness adjacent. It's very closely related to all these different questions, but it isn't maybe the heart of what people think of as consciousness. But it turns out in people, one of the ways that we model or understand attention, especially visual attention, is by means of this weird sub-threshold tendency to perceive beams coming out of people's eyes. Now, this is really weird, but when you look at someone attending to something, like there's John and he's paying a lot of attention to whatever, a coffee cup. you may not know it, but your brain is essentially drawing a moving arrow from John's eyes to the coffee cup. And that moving arrow is literally built into your brain. Like, your visual motion machinery is...
Says him. Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Generating a motion signal and painting it onto the scene, flowing from John's eyes to the coffee cup. It's one of the ways that we build a... It's sort of like when you look at, you know, when football commentators draw their arrows on the field to keep track of things in a very schematic way. It's not like the football field actually has arrows on it. It's just a useful way to keep track of what's going on. So our brains do this. Our brains build arrows, draw arrows on the social world to keep track of who's paying attention to what. And we do this. We all do this. And we do this.
I don't know why this is this even a subject. How the hell can you project that bullshit and say that that has... that that's any kind of a common reaction, that we all look at somebody staring and draw an arrow? I don't think so.
Very sub-threshold level. It can't be super vivid, otherwise it would interfere with our vision. Like, we can't actually literally see things flowing out of the eyes, or it screw up our ability to see the world. So it's very faint. It's very sub-threshold, it's very faint, but it's there. And we can show that. We can show that in a lot of different ways. I mean, one of the easy ways is to put someone in a scanner and show them a picture of John looking at the coffee cup, and sure enough, the visual motion areas light up as though there's something flowing from one to the other, right? That's an easy way to do it. There are other ways to do it.
So visual motion areas. So this all just has to do with what they've assigned brain functions and decide that every time that piece of the brain does something, it means butterfly or whatever. And no, that's a conclusion the brain draws. There isn't some place that has the complete answer. You can't just poke a piece of brain and say, this is the sentence, blah, 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 or this is the paragraph. Or no, it's not. The brain isn't constructed that way. So I just call bullshit.
So if you stare long enough at John looking at the coffee cup, then you develop a motion after effect in the in-between area. Motion after effect.
Yeah, right. That just might be your own eyeballs going from his eyes to the coffee cup, and you're just doing this. You're not drawing an arrow. You're just recognizing that there's two objects, and the two objects are now tied to each other. He's looking at the computer screen, you know. Well, whatever. This is just such weak mush.
Like the waterfall effect. You see water flowing one direction, and then you look at something stationary and it looks like it's drifting the other direction. That's a motion adaptation effect. You can generate a motion adaptation effect by looking at other people gazing at things, because our brains are busy drawing these moving arrows on other people, on trying to understand the social world. And so this is weird, but...
Ugh, whatever. They ought to try to figure out why, you know, why people buy machines that, stick dildos in and out of their ass. You know, that would be more interesting as a subject. Long commercial, and I have no idea where it was about. They showed some little, almost an A symbol. I don't know. Is that Alphabet, Google, or something? People sitting on a wall. It's totally obscure. How the fuck could that commercial influence anybody? What a waste of my time. I mean, if you're going to commercial me, I'll be able to know what the fuck you're selling.
It's convenient. It makes evolutionary sense because it makes it easier to keep track of our social world. And it might explain culturally why there's this huge amount of kind of cultural belief in things like beams coming out of the eyes and evil eyes. And you can feel someone stare poking the back of your neck. You know, you go through culture, it's suffused with this stuff. Like Superman has X-ray vision. But weirdly, it always involves some beams coming out of his eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, or the old... idea of the ancient Greeks of...
Oh, shit. So this is just saying we probably shouldn't watch cartoons because they give us ideas that really aren't very realistic. You know, like you could slap a duck's beak and it would spin around its head. Some things probably don't do your brain any good. So, don't watch too much SpongeBob.
Vision by something flowing out of your eyes and touching objects. Like, these ideas come naturally to us, partly because we have a system in our brains built in to think of the world in that way, just because it's easy, not because it's accurate, because it's an easy way to model the world. I think it plays into traditional concepts of consciousness as an energy-like essence inside that can flow out of the body at times. I think it's part and parcel of that larger set of beliefs. But here's...
Now, all the bullshit just starts because people raise their kids with bullshit, and they learn how to bullshit. So once it becomes legal for a kid to know, oh, we can just make shit up? they start making shit up, you know, and making the world fit what they want it to be rather than what it is, because they find out from the lying parents that that's totally legal. If a kid is raised in a strictly rational environment where deception is seen as evil and nasty, they're not going to have any room for all that crap, and they're not going to be part of that crap.
The thing, now that we know people have this and we can measure this in people, even though you may not know it, we put you through these experiments, we'll find it in you. We can do that on non-human animals too. We can do the same experiments. We haven't yet, as it happens, and it's something that I think would be really interesting to try.
I think we know these experiments are all bullshit. They're all just three-card Monty bullshit tricks. You know, show enough B's and D's and somehow you'll confuse somebody and eventually they'll identify a B as a D.
But I am willing to bet that social animals, like monkeys or like dogs, probably, or really social birds, probably have exactly the same mechanism. They're probably all perceiving faint beams coming out of each other's eyes. They're all probably perceiving the mind energy flowing out toward things, right? And so in that sense, they all share at a raw...
Oh, he's just making all this crap up. This, whatever this crap is, this is just crap. I don't know. I mean, maybe he has some kind of syndrome where, you know, he sees a bunch of beams coming out of everything, but I can say I don't see any beams, no please.
First order level, they all share the same kind of thing that leads to some of our superstitions.
My own experience with my animals tells me that you're spot on, just because my dog in particular is always looking at my eyes, and if I look at the cat, if I look at something on the wall, he doesn't care that much. If I look at the cat, then he has to go get in front of the cat and start pawing at me to make sure that I pay him attention instead of the cat. But I am with you 100% that I'm in principle of...
So all of that mush to describe the fact that we're all possessive, and I mean, that's almost like just saying that you know, there's some guy at a restaurant looking at your wife or something, you know, and it would bug you. Wow. Oh, gee.
Posed to magical theories of consciousness. So I just want to, I'm saying this to preface that I am not trying to trick you with what I want, with what I am about to ask.
Yeah.
And I don't have magical presuppositions in asking these questions, but I want to return to these three reasons that I said I was interested in animal consciousness. And before we talk about how they might relate
Yay.
To animals, I just want to get a baseline by seeing how you would answer them with respect to humans. How do you answer the question, is it like anything to be a human?
Not in the sense that people and philosophers mean. I think that the idea that there exists a what it is like, that idea is itself a simplified self-model, right? It's as accurate, it's the way we depict ourselves, and it's as accurate and true to reality as the I-beams are true to reality. Like, there are no I-beams in reality. The brain constructs, you know, a model and says, well, let's just pretend that's true because it makes life easier. That's what I think is going on with the what it is like component. It just makes it easier for the brain to keep track of itself and its world, to tell itself it has that.
Because being like something is inherently magical. And so...
Well, whatever. So this being like something, when we know that being a human 200 years ago was very different than being a human now, okay? And being a human a million years ago was very different than being a human now. So you can recognize that we were totally involved in a completely different matrix, you know, in terms of knowledge. So we go to school for 18 years. We spend a long time having lots of interrelationships with people and friendships, and we have to go through this whole process of learning about how fragile they all are, how it all falls apart, how tragic it all is, and all this kind of crap. And so we have a gigantic context in terms of what we have to live our lives with, where, you know, people 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago didn't have that same context.
So the brain can tell itself that there is something magical going on, but it's not. It's just a simpler way of keeping track of things going on
yeah.
in the brain.
What is it? I mean, essentially the brain is telling it, I mean, if you went through the exercise and imagine a brain says, I'm paying attention to it. I'm paying attention to the red apple. It's really, you know, the red is saturated. I'm paying attention to it means I'm not paying attention to other things. I'm really focusing on that and I'm processing it in depth.
Because it's different. Again, we're just recognizing things that are the same and things that are different. and that's it. And we react to something that's very the same, and we react to something that's very different.
Overwhelms my processing, and it means that I can understand it and I can choose to react to it and all these great things, but I don't really want to know about the details of attention, because I don't want to know about neurons and how they connect to each other and all the mechanism. So let's throw all the details out, and instead let's depict an essence inside of me that has no physical details. It's just an essence, and it's the essence.
Let's do neither one. Let's not get lost in neurons or memory chips and lose the whole idea of what the computer's doing. So, let's not look too deep and let's not look too broad. Let's try to find something where we can get the idea that there's functions and, that there's a combination of mechanisms. Brain's doing more than one thing, and the brain combines those different sources, like your senses, and it's just adding more information than the senses are adding. It's adding its memories, and it's adding its other things, the photographs it took, to the image, and it's superimposing all of that and calling that your consciousness.
Of vivid experience, and that's a good enough way to depict the fact that I'm paying attention to that red apple. That's what I think is going on. And it's not so much the benefit of it is not so much that it's magical and the brain can say, oh, I'm magic. It's the benefit is that it's a simple way of the brain saying, I'm paying attention to it with all the consequent things that allows me to do. But I don't have to worry as a brain. I don't have to worry about all the physical mechanical details. So I'm essentially therefore telling myself I have a property that lacks physical details. It's free floating. It's magical in that sense. That's what I think is going on. That's
why
I think.
Why does he just keep talking about all this magical crap he doesn't believe in? And why is he saying, well, that's what we think and that's what we do? No, we don't necessarily do any of that crap. So why are you wasting my time calling me stupid? Fuck you.
Subjective experience is. It's like the eye beams. It's a useful way to keep track of yourself.
Ugh, crap. Ew, that commercial was a baby, and they were talking about big ideas. Yeah, it's a big idea. Oh, right. Tying yourself to a bomb that could explode at any moment. What a brilliant idea.
Thing I wanted to ask, and if the spirit moves you, I am happy to get, or I would like to get more technical on this question, is whether or not human beings are capable of suffering, and whatever suffering is, how exactly is it instantiated in the human brain?
So why would he ask this question? Are human beings capable of suffering? I don't need to ask somebody else. I mean, I'm doing it, so don't tell me I'm not doing it. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Do human beings suffer? I mean, it's a ridiculous question. I mean, what the fuck? He's asking a PhD university professor, okay? Do we have feet? Yeah.
Well, let me start with this. One of the examples I really like, I mentioned it already, is the color white. Because in the real world, the physical world, there's reflectance spectra everywhere, and some of those spectra are uneven and some are much more even. And the very even ones, at least across the visible part of the spectrum, that's what we call white. And that's not how the brain processes it. The brain says there's three color channels and a brightness channel. Actually, at some point, the brain recombines and turns it into four color channels, yellow, blue, red, and green, and then there's brightness. And when we look at something white, the model the brain constructs is very simple. It says all the color channels are down low and the brightness channel is up high. That's what white is. And of course, that's not what white is physically. It's a totally incoherent description of the color white. Newton is the one who figured that out and figured out, no, white is a mixture of all wavelengths. So now we, 300 years later, we look at white and we all have this weird fractured way of understanding it because we've all gone to school. So we all know that white is a mixture of all colors. It's not true that it got purified or the contaminants got stripped out of it. We all know that. But that doesn't change the model that our visual system constructs. We're born with it. We can't, it's like we don't have a top-down intellectual way of.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that system. It perfectly is coherent to the world we exist in. White should be, all right, different color, okay, than the primary, the elemental color. So obviously we wouldn't be able to see anything. So it makes perfectly good sense. I don't even understand why there'd be an argument about this, that white is a color. Just like all the other sub-colors you can make, the 3 million of them.
Fixing our visual system, and it wouldn't do us any good anyway, because there's a good reason why the visual system simplifies the world so that we can process it with a limited amount of neural hardware. That's why it's so simple. So we have a reflexive visual model, which tells us that white is one thing, pure, clean, uncontaminated. And we have an intellectual model that we learned in school, which tells us that white is something else. It's a mixture of all things.
All these conflict and stuff, this doesn't have anything to do with suffering, so that I'm pretty damn sure. And that suffering is made out of some sort of component primary colors seems ridiculous. So, you know, look, your brain knows there's, the fact is there's these frequencies of light. So you have the, you know, 2 to 3 and then 3 to 5 and then 5 to 7, whatever the way you want to calculate it. 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4. So these are the frequencies that you can possibly see, and they just, you know, your brain just says, well, the high ones are going to be the blue, and then the middle ones will be this, and the ones on the end would be red. So what's wrong with that? Perfectly reasonable. I mean, there is no color, okay, in the actual environment. It's just a frequency.
Bloodiest color there is. And we walk around happily with both of those in our head at the same time, and one does not negate the other. They both exist at the same time in our heads, and we have to deal with that. And everyone's okay with it, because it's been hundreds of years now that we've been dealing with it, and we all got used to it. That exact same way of thinking is going to have to apply to all aspects of consciousness.
Oh, brother. So what, this is just such crap. It doesn't have anything to do with the knee jerk. It doesn't have anything to do with how we feel pressure. I mean, this is just bullshit.
Right, so you ask, well, do people really experience suffering? And there's this whole intellectual scientific way of understanding it that says, well, experience isn't really what we think it is, and it's computation and this and that, and this is all true, but no matter how much you understand that intellectually, it does not change the reflexive models. Right, those are still doing their thing, they're still building their things and pumping information through the rest of our brain.
So this is the part where they're so stupid they can't see the forest through the trees, kind of thing, or however you want to argue. I mean, it's clearly essential to our function is a reward and punishment mechanism. The fucking sensations exist, all right, to impose value on us. It's synthesized value. It's not something else. It's not some just waste product. It's not just something the brain does for no good reason. Fuck.
And so if someone takes a needle and stabs you, you're still going to go, hey, that hurt. Stop that. That's awful. I don't want that to happen to me. Like, that's going to happen. And the emotional associations, the emotional processing, and all the emotional circuitry that people really don't understand, that's going to get engaged. So there's a version in which aesthetically people suffer. And there's a version in which intellectually, as we understand the computations, something much more sophisticated and materialistic is going on. So there's a scientific way of understanding it, but then there's the user way of understanding it.
It's just too silly. What's the point of having the word if you can't identify it? The feelings are so easily identified as being positive and negative, pleasant and unpleasant. This is just such a pile of evasive crap.
So I do not think that understanding it from the scientific perspective negates the user suffering or joy or whatever, right? So do people...
Dissecting the human does not change the fact that the goddamn human, when it's conscious, is going to have these sensations. So, fuck, there's no dissection that stops that from happening. The water goes into the bucket, so to speak. You can't stop it because you dissected the bucket. It's just retarded. God, this guy is so full of shit.
Suffer, yeah, there's a sense in which people suffer, of course. Pain is there.
Then why did you say all that crap? What was the crap for? You're trying to imply that it's there, but it's, oh, if we really look at it scientifically, it's not there. No, it's obviously there, and it does serve a really vital role in our function because, yes, we react to it as a reward and a punishment. Now, yeah, the brain could have made it so it didn't really hurt, and instead cause some reflexive action that we couldn't override. Maybe that would have been possible, but unfortunately that's not what it fell on. So when it was making synthetic value, it actually made real value. Now it would have been better if it made synthetic value because then we wouldn't feel anything negative. But it didn't make synthetic value. It made something really harsh and nasty.
I think that probably these mechanisms of attention and consciousness that we study, if they get damaged, and they do sometimes in people with stroke damage, Sometimes that suffering, you know, you can have a person that no longer feels pain and no longer suffers. That, you know, there's something.
Oh, shit. So that's so bizarre. And so, I mean, lepers, that's leprosy. You know, I mean, that's a lot of things, but it's, you know, what does that have to do? That's nothing to do with the fact that this is how you have to live your life. It's with this jeopardy of, you know, great risk. And there's even suffering in having to contemplate that jeopardy, because the flight and fight response is saying, well, run away. Why are you living? Because you're just being subjected to this jeopardy. And then you start to calculate how you get out of here, out of the boat, and you realize, well, that's jeopardy too. You know, as soon as I jump in the water, I'm going to get eaten by the sharks. You know, that kind of crap.
As I've written about many times, called hemispatial neglect, where half of space and half of your body kind of gets wiped from your awareness, and you poke them with a pin, and they might squirm, but they don't really know what happened or why. And the brain is processing the information, but not in that particular way. And so there's validity.
So whatever, that's a really substantial stroke. I mean, I had a stroke, so I know something about strokes, and I know that your brain has to reuse. It has to use stuff you're already using to rewrite the stuff you have to learn. And so it gets a little messy because it kind of splits it up on the hard drive, so to speak. So you still have some kind of function, but it's been cut in half in terms of how well you can do the one thing to do the thing you used to be able to do, that you're cheating and stealing some of the drive space.
To the intellectual side, that's getting away from the experience and the magicalism, but there's also validity to the user experience, basically. And so
yeah. You can't just answer the question and say, shit, yeah, being conscious is a bitch. You know, you're vulnerable. Any minute something can happen to you and it's going to hurt like fucking hell. It's going to be obnoxious as hell. It'll be insane. I mean, I wake up with leg cramps now and then. It's just like, shit, that 30 seconds of you know, muscle ripping pain, and you're just like, what? I couldn't do that for more than 30 seconds, that's for sure.
Yeah, people can suffer. Animals can suffer. Yes.
I have seen my fair share of neuroscience papers, even though I'm not a neuroscientist, and I know that you and your people are very fond of extremely intricate diagrams.
Ah.
And so I'm not going to ask for the extremely detailed picture, but can you give me...
Is that what's in the back? Is this his office or your office? You know, it's a good question. What is all this junk? You know, what the hell is this story? All right, back.
A rough idea of what happens when the needle jabs into your arm.
So the needle is such a bad example, because most needles, you don't feel them at first, and it takes a while, and you have to be in there and wiggle it a while. It takes, you know, needles are like nothing. They're almost unfeelable.
Ends up resulting in something happening in your brain that correlates with or corresponds.
Why'd you do nail in your fucking eye?
To the
needle in your eye. You're going to feel that.
Subjective experience of pain, right, and suffering.
So most people who study it are, there are pain nerves.
Nociceptors?
Yes, nociceptors.
Nociceptors.
And there's tons of different kinds. It's the most diverse set of peripheral nerves. Lots of different categories, and there's, you know, temperature, and there's extreme cold, which is a type of pain, and extreme heat, and then there's sharp pain, which is transmitted through very fast fibers, and there's the sort of dull throbbing pain transmitted through very slow fibers, and all kinds of other things that people study in the periphery. That is not pain. That's the peripheral signaling mechanism. And obviously that's not pain, because if you have all the nerves perfectly intact, but then you sever their connection to the brain, the person doesn't feel any pain, right? That's not the same thing as pain. So then they get into the brain and they make their central connections.
I would just like to point out that you made it to
it's
me.
It's just the information can be painful. So that's, again, just a perception. Somebody tells you you didn't win the lottery and you spent, you know, the house mortgage on it and your life is ruined. Boo-hoo. You know, it's going to be painful.
A very interesting observation, because I have been pondering over, for instance, whether or not certain types of shrimp feel pain. And yes, they have nociceptors, but they don't have a brain, the type that I'm looking at. They don't have a centralized nervous system, at least. But that just popped into my brain, but please keep going.
I mean, I think you're...
I think it's almost ridiculous. I don't know what shrimp he's talking about, but every shrimp I saw has got a fucking brain. There's no way they can do all of the shit they do without a brain. I mean, that's just nonsense. I mean, maybe they've disguised it, you know, somewhere, but it's got a brain. You can't. They can't build all that those little houses and do all that crap if they don't got a brain.
Right. I don't think shrimp feel pain. I don't think shrimp feel in the same sense that we understand the word. I don't think they have those same self models that we have. It's possible they have some really simple precursor versions, but I suspect not. But that would be for further study.
Yeah, I'd like to come back.
Yeah. So yeah, I definitely argue that that's absolutely nonsense. I mean, shrimp interact with fish. They catch prey. They do all kinds of crap. I don't know how somebody can say they don't have a brain and they're not valid players. It just sounds so ridiculous.
Back to the shrimp. I'm sorry for throwing you off the track. But okay, so the pain hits the, or not the pain, but because there's no pain yet. Needle hits arm.
Yeah.
Nociceptors send signal up to the neck. If the spinal cord is severed, there's no pain, but suppose it's intact.
Right. So now they.
So let's understand. They're saying that we have specific nerves that don't do anything but create pain. And I'm saying, no, that's bullshit. It's a combination thing. You can just put pressure on nerves. You can do all kinds of things to cause the nerves to instigate a sensation of pain. So I don't think there's only one kind of nerve that creates pain, but whatever.
There's these central connections, and there's tons of them. There's connections for pain. Actually, the first connection is in the spinal cord. There's a secondary neuron, and then that goes up to the brain. The secondary neuron synapses, there's all kinds of, there's a place in something called the thalamus, where there's another synapse, where the neurons come in and they connect to the third neuron in line. And then the third neuron goes all over the brain and branches out, and there's cortical areas that receive information, right? So all of this is processing information about events on the surface of the...
So you know that somebody can have, they can lose their arm and they have the ghost pain. So we know the pain isn't because he has a neural receptor creating the pain. We know that it's somewhere further along in the branching.
Skin.
When you say that there's a secondary and then a tertiary neuron, do you literally mean that there is one neuron or there's a type of neuron and it's actually like 1,000 or 1,000,000 neurons that are getting activated right here and then moving into the...
Right. Rectum? So there are millions, but they're in parallel.
Okay.
So you can literally trace a single neuron if you wanted to from your foot all the way up to your spinal cord. Like that's one really long...
Yeah, it's one neuron, one cell.
Neuron. It's a very, very thin single cell connecting your foot to your upper spinal cord. And yet, there's, of course, millions of those all in parallel with each other. And you activate one of them, and you should be able to feel the pain, ultimately. But normally, you're activating many of them. Yes. So that's the first neuron in line that connects your foot to your arm to your the spinal cord first relay, so to speak, in the pain sequence. And the second one, the second bundle of neurons, goes from the spinal cord up into the thalamus, which is this central structure in the brain. The thalamus serves the cortex. It's this thing like the pit at the heart of the cortical outer covering, and it evolved with the cortex, and it grew massively as the cortex grew, so it's part of that whole machinery. And then the third set of neurons transmits from the thalamus up into the cortex in really rich, complicated ways, and pain branches out all over the place. There's lots and lots of other areas in the brain that process pain. But there is
So am I getting into this? What causes it? Again, this mechanical process of, we know that it's triggered, and that's all you really need to know, is that it's triggered. And it can be triggered by this subtle bullshit. I mean, you can have a pain in the wrong location, sciatica, because you compressed a nerve. And that triggered a nerve inside the nerve, fiber, and simulated the actual event that didn't take place that is pain.
And most people who study pain perception study that. They're studying the representations of it. They're studying how the information is represented and coded. That is not the same thing as subjective experience, which is that's a component that you typically don't find in studies of pain, right? Those are much more anchored to the nuts and bolts. But you do have this final layer, which is the subjective experience itself. And so, in theory, it's possible to have all those mechanisms in operation, active, crackling.
Mike, why call anything the subjective experience itself? It's always subjective, duh. So why don't you just call it the experience? It's just the experience. It's subjective, duh. I mean, duh, it happens to in my brain. It's not going to happen in somebody else's brain. It's not gonna, so, yes, it's my experience. It's this brain's experience. Why do we need to throw this silly subjective word in? Duh, it's subjective. It's real, though. Subjective, see, they're just using the word to imply that it's somehow not objective, that it's somehow not in the real world, that it's some sort of made-up thing. Well, everything's made up from the brain's perspective. The brain synthesizes the world. It consumes it, processes it, and then reproduces a version of it.
The way firing your weight and yet not have that final subjective experience component active, and then you don't feel pain. Then you're like the proverbial zombie. The machinery is there, but the experiential component is missing. But I would say what's missing is the final stage of self-models that allows you to say, I am a person and I'm feeling this right now. And I don't.
So it's kind of funny, right? Because zombies are always going, you know, they're pretty miserable. So it's pretty silly to say they're not experiencing. They look pretty miserable. They act pretty miserable. whatever. I mean, you should say robot, not zombie. You know, or do, you know, say some other, you know, use some other silly metaphor. Just so bad. Yuck. Let's just, take a break. All right, let's see, finish up this hour anyway. Kind of a boring one.
I don't like it, right? That final stage of self-model could be missing. So that's what I think is involved. There's layers on layers of processing, and the raw, nociceptive input is processed in very complex ways, and then experience itself is processed in a different way. And when all of those are stacked on top of each other, that's when you get someone saying, ah, this is awful, I feel pain, and it's, I don't like the experience.
Terrific. And then the third thing that I wanted to ask before we get back into...
So I wonder if the feelings of, like, nausea or, you know these more, intangible-type awful feelings, are they going to also associate them with a specific kind of nerve that causes them? I mean, come on. I don't think so. But anyway, we'll go with it. Fine. Next. I'm still going to argue that there's no good reason to discount the intelligence of shrimp, because they're pretty smart.
Some of these things in more detail is whether or not you think there's something intrinsically valuable to a human being conscious.
Right. So the more I study the matter...
I mean, some species of shrimp, I suppose you always have to recognize that it's just like simians or something. You know, there's a scale, so there's probably really smart shrimp and really dumb shrimp.
The less it seems
like a sand flea or something.
Morally important. And the more it seems to be pragmatically important.
Ah, you're brilliant, commercial.
I find this to be a very interesting answer, because I've also been thinking a lot about metaethics and whether or not there are moral facts and properties at all. And if you think that human life and consciousness aren't valuable, things that ought to be promoted, it just seems like that is maybe the sort of canonical good thing. And if you don't think that this is good and morally important, then you're probably a moral anti-realist and you don't think that there are good or bad things more generally.
Right. So, well, I mean, as a neuroscientist, I do think morality is a product of the brain. And I do think morality stems more from emotion than anything else.
Right. So the moral...
So he's saying it's just some sort of emotional defect that you ponder the fact that you suffer and it sucks. And then you ponder the fact that other people suffer and it sucks for them, for sure. And it just sucks in general if you recognize that it's a brain experiencing shit. And that sucks. That's negative. That's bad. I know it's bad when my brain is feeling shit. So why wouldn't it be bad when some other brain is manifesting shit? So, and he says that's an emotional reaction. Fuck you, fatty.
Realist, there are debates in philosophy about what these terms ought to mean.
Yeah.
Thinks that there are mind-independent moral facts.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
You're a moral anti-realist on this classification because you think that moral facts are mind-dependent. They're things we generate.
Yes. On the other hand, I got them on.
I mean, just idiotic, right? I mean, I'm just saying overtly, I mean, how can you be this fucking stupid? you know that you'll pay real money to evade these horrible experiences. You know you'll do it. And you're just saying that somehow I don't have any moral obligation to be bothered if it's some other brain doing it, even though I know the brain is doing exactly what my brain is doing, that somehow I can disconnect from that because the only one I care about is me. Oh, fuck. The only one I'm emotionally connected to is me. You know. No, I'm not smart enough to figure out it doesn't matter what brain it's in. It doesn't matter who has the broken leg. The broken leg is the bad thing. Oh, this is so fucking ignorant.
Mind.
Exactly.
And so I have morals.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, of course, I'm a moral person and I want to support certain things and I'm very much against other things. And I think...
And he's just basically trying to argue that I'm an irrational moral piece of shit. That I just made it up emotionally because of some, you know, my personal experience sticking my fingers up my ass. I mean, what a pile of shit. They're absolute facts about our existence. They're circumstantial facts. Okay, I cut your hand off, your arm will bleed. Okay, it's going to happen to every single person you do it to. Come on, this is just such bullshit.
Morals are typically very, the basic set of morals are really similar across people because our brains are very similar and we evolved in similar ways.
Oh, this is just so fucking stupid. No, we're all living in the same goddamn black, white, simple, obvious fire, no fire world where we know the goddamn difference. We know the difference between something that's going to hurt and something that doesn't hurt. And we know that it's a goddamn much better not to do the hurt thing. I mean, come on. This is just such bullshit. We can add this 2 + 2 and get 4. It's not an emotional 4. It's a factual 4. What happened there? Who the hell knows? All right, well, maybe we'll... Yeah, I almost hate to pause there, right? All right, we'll play a little more.
And we're all enmeshed in human cultures which share similarities. There's no question.
So he's really saying that. He's really saying that these ignorant, stupid cultures, these sadist, idiotic, moronic cultures are just as valid. They're not really morons, okay? So when they threw their daughters in the volcano, they weren't morons. If they knock their kids' teeth out because it looks cool, they're not morons. Oh, fuck you. They're morons.
You know, it goes back to what
if
I was...
If they enslave other people, they're not morons. Yeah, they're morons. Oh, fuck.
Saying about the color white. Like, you can understand intellectually in one way, but you are a user. And so you cannot escape the other angle on it. I think this is the same thing with morality.
What do you mean you can't escape it? So again, that's the guy's basically arguing right now that he's going to escape being a meat eater if he draws the conclusion that, shit, I'm being an asshole. You know, I'm being a sadistic jackass. I can figure out I don't want to be known as sadistic jackass, so I don't want that label. So, yeah, I can figure it out and say, okay, I'm going to change. No big deal. Oh, fuck.
I can understand intellectually the idea that morality evolved. And it's a construct of our brains, and it's really...
Again, so he's talking like it's a mechanical thing that evolved when it didn't have to do any of that. It's the truth, and you discover it. It doesn't evolve. You discover it, period.
...useful in any kind of larger social system. That's the intellectual side, but I'm also a user, and I got him.
This isn't something I want to get into too much depth with, but you've said a number of very... this whole conversation, you've been saying very interesting things, but in particular, a couple of words you just used are pragmatic and useful. And within metaethics, there is a family of views called moral quasi-realism.
Fuck this. I mean, metaethics to start with, what the fuck does that even mean? There's ethics, period. Rules. Laws of adding and subtracting. Logic. And then the rest of this, whatever this other babble is.
Quasi-realist does not...
Quasi-realist?
...believe that there are these mind-independent moral truths, but they think that...
Mind-independent moral truths. It's like saying that, you know, if I say that Old Faithful blows up every hour or pretty close to it, I can describe things that happen in the physical world. There's no point in having an argument. I could talk about the genome of a particular tree. I could do And they're absolute facts. There's no fucking ambiguity at all. They're absolute facts. There's no ambiguity.
Again, speaking very loosely, that we ought to take a pragmatic and useful attitude toward these terms and recognize that we have minds that experience the world in a moral dimension, that they're very useful.
Okay, the mind experiences the world in a moral dimension. There's no moral dimension. There's just facts about our existence. The simple argument is that we know the difference between these feelings. We know negative and we know positive. And we can understand that negative, bad, okay, positive, good, okay, there, we're done. Now we just have to find out, you know, how to do the addition and subtraction. How negative are the negatives and how positive are the positives?
Qualities for living as people, and so we ought to be...
Men die. Fuck, another one of those. All right, so maybe I'll call this a video and such, and then we can replace some of that in the next one. All right, so enough of a video. Till the next time and such, so forth and whatnot. God, I hate this goddamn planet. You people are motherfucking cunts. How the fuck can they sit there and have an argument about we can't figure out that we feel, and we can't figure out that we feel good and we feel bad, and then we can't figure out that there's an ethical exchange, a commodity of this feeling good and feeling bad, and we can't make all the bad feelings, dump them on one guy, and then we take all the profits. That's unethical. It's criminal to torture something, to enslave something, to cause unnecessary suffering because you wouldn't want it to happen to you, you lying scum.